honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. In the weeks ahead, we're going to meet some World War II Marines, male and female, and even a 100-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor. But I felt compelled to dedicate this week's program to Mert Wiedemann because he was such a powerful example of what motivated me to start this program in the first place so many years ago. It wasn't just what he did during World War II, but what he did, who he was, and what he represented in all the years that followed. Mert passed away this past week at the age of 97. A memorial service in his native Shafter, California will take place on Saturday, October 30th. For decades, he owned and operated the local pharmacy. And here are a couple more choice comments from the Hometown Heroes Facebook page when Mert first shared his story on the radio in 2016. Steve Rosell wrote, "My sister Valerie and I grew up in Shafter in the 50s and 60s. Mert was a pillar of the community and, like others have said, made us feel like family. We'll always remember the image of Mert in his white pharmacy smock and dark hair looking out from his busy work podium. He always had time to greet and chat with people while industriously filling prescriptions. He made Shafter a community. As a kid infected with all things aeronautical, he never said a word to me about his military service, but looking back, Mert would always look you in the eye and stand straight." Elena Espinoza posted, "I just love this man. He was the best boss ever. Mert has a heart of gold and loves people. He treated everyone with kindness and respect." When Mert Wiedemann was 50 years old, he became a licensed pilot. He flew his plane from Shafter to the other pharmacies he had acquired. The runways were a lot smoother than the coral runway he had used at Eniwetok during World War II. But back then, he wasn't at the controls. Mert was riding along in Navy bombers as a weather officer, sitting up front between the pilot and co-pilot in a plane fully loaded with bullets and bombs.
It had six turrets, right, two on top, one on each side, one in the tail and one in the front. Those guys went in that Typhoon in their position for as gunners. So the gunner in the tail, he was strapped in there with his machine gun, and the two on top were strapped in there with their, and so they were strapped in there. They weren't sitting in a chair or something inside, which is kind of interesting. So they were all in their fighting positions when they went in there, because you don't have, well, first place, you don't have room in the bomber to, you know, you have the bombs all in the center, and you have the radioman sitting there at his desk, and it was tough on those kids.
Yeah, and so to hammer home your point here, this is a PB-4Y-2, which is a B-24 that's been converted to Navy use. They call it a privateer. And so it's fully loaded with bombs and fully staffed with gunners. So if you guys see a Japanese target, they would spring into action.
That's right.
And you're along for the ride, and you sat right up front between the pilots?
Yeah, I sat. They have a jump seat there.
And so as you get into the Typhoon...
I'm still in the jump seat.
And you're looking at the instrument panel. And what are the readings that you're getting from that instrument panel?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I'm supposed to get ready, but lots of times you can read them. I mean, it's raining, it's dark, bouncing up and down, and just your head is just going from one side to the other, and you're scared to death you're going to go down.
Can you see where you're going?
Well, you can, but it's visibility isn't good.
Yeah.
But the pilots, this one pilot we had, 26 years old, Russ Hamilton, and I went with a lot of pilots, but he was a top. He was just so calm and just had a lot of respect for him. In fact, we became very good friends after the war and visited each other.
One thing you said when you introduced this idea of Typhoon reconnaissance, you said you were the first Navy weather officer to fly into a Typhoon on purpose.
That's right.
The implication is a lot of the guys who flew into Typhoons not on purpose didn't live to tell the story.
Probably.
Can you give us a sense of some of those moments where you start to think, you know, I'm going to end up like those guys? I'm not going to get out of this? This plane's not going to make it out of this?
Well, you learn to pray.
I bet. What do you pray?
I pray that we get out of it. Uh-huh. You're just praying for yourself and the crew.
Yeah.
Not thinking about your family or any... Well, you're thinking about losing, you know, never seeing them again. But, you know, people don't realize that that's how the Navy got the information, where his planes went out there in those typhoons. And they're doing the same thing today in the Gulf.
Hurricanes.
And of course, you have a lot of different planes, too. But then when you compare it to what I went through, I was in a warm airplane and secured, and I got through it. And it was a rough thing, a scared thing to death about it. But then you think about these kids. It doesn't even compare how bad it was for those kids. I hate to even talk about it because I hate to even get any credit for that because when I think about all the terrible things they had to do in the invasion of Europe and the invasion of these islands, you know, just killed on the beach. And so I hate to even talk about myself.
Well,
you know, I really do. It just doesn't compare with what those young 18-year-old kids went through on those beaches to take those islands. And people ought to know about that and not forget that, what those kids did sacrifice.
Well, amen. And I'll tell you, you're not alone. Just about everybody I've had on this program shares similar sentiments, that they don't think they should be the ones that get the attention. It should be those, especially the ones who didn't come home, 406,000 Americans. But you came close enough to adding to that number, and you put your life at risk, and you knew you were putting your life at risk with a pregnant wife back home. And I think the other thing that we need to try to understand here is I wonder how many lives you helped save, you with that crew, to fly into those typhoons and to glean whatever you could about their tendencies and their nature and what they were going to do. That probably did save some lives in the future.
Oh, I'm sure it did, because the Navy later on had typhoons, you know, that they had to reckon with, but at least they knew where they were, and there was avoidance problem or taking the lesser side of the typhoon, you know. But anyway, I mean, it did. I know it saved lives. And it's something that people don't even think about. I mean, nobody has ever heard of the typhoon reconnaissance.
Well, they have now, because you're telling your story. And I know there's a lot more to your story. And just with that part of it, of flying into the typhoons, is there anything else that you can share to help us understand what that really feels like when you're entering or exiting that typhoon? I mean, is it like getting put in a blender, getting shaken all around? Or how would you describe it?
You think the plane is going down. It's going sideways. It's going up and down. You know, when you hit those tremendous updrafts, gosh, you know, it's like going into overland and hit a tornado, you know. That's about like, you don't want to fly into a tornado. You don't want to fly into a thunderstorm,
right?
You know. And that's what it was, just like a big thunderstorm. I don't know what to tell you other than just you're frightened and you have no choice, just like the pilot has no choice. He didn't want to go in there.
Mm-hmm.
They hated it.
When did you find out that you were a father?
1 month after the baby was born. The baby was born on September 15th. We went to the Navy church there and I gave thanks. The baby had arrived all right and it was doing okay. My father-in-law sent a telegram.
Well, that was good news. And about 2 weeks before that, there was really good news because the Japanese signed the surrender on the USS Missouri. I understand your pilot was flying that day and put a scare into some Japanese. Were you on that plane or no?
Yeah, at Ponape we went. There's a ridge of trees that extend out from the harbor. He came in real low. Now, the armistice was being signed that day, and he came in very low, right over the deck, and he lifted up the plane up over those trees and dropped down into that harbor there, and the Japanese just jumped off the boats. You know, everybody, they were diving in the water, and of course, retrospect, I thought, that was really dumb. What if they took a shot at him? They wouldn't care. I mean, nobody would know it. If they shot down a plane, except they would know it.
Yeah.
And just do it for the kicks, just like we're doing it for the kicks. So it was a dumb thing to do. Very dumb thing to do.
I understand another thing you guys had a chance to do with that plane, which after all is a bomber, was you guys dropped something, but it wasn't bombs. You dropped some goodies for the kids down there?
You know, it's just amazing how those guys out of their own pockets, as a number of atolls, like Bikini Atoll, where they had the bomb later on, there were just natives living there, no Japanese. And then below Ponape, there was another island, not a very big island. I know we used to go around it, had a church on it, and it wasn't even part of the picture. They just took the plane out of way to go down there. Some way they'd been there before. And so this one crew always loaded up the plane. They had clothing, they had candy bars, they just a bunch of stuff. And so the pilot would fly right down on the deck. I mean, he'd be below the treetops with that four-engine bomber, right over the water, right over the beach. Everybody come running out. They knew what to expect. They all come out there on the beach, all those people. And then they'd drop down. The kids would kick off these packages to them, you know, and take another round, and they'd all scrambling to open them up, candy bars and what have you. And they all paid for it, you know. It wasn't anything they Navy furnished or anything.
Uh-huh.
May furnish the clothing or furnish some things.
That must have felt pretty good to be a part of that.
Oh, it was fun to watch them.
Kind of like being Santa Claus?
Yeah, I would love to have gone down there and visited that island or some of the other atolls. We flew over atolls nobody was on. You know, water surrounded by islands. And you just think how much fun it would be to take a boat there into that atoll and onto those little islands. They all had a few coconut trees. One atoll we went by, it was south of Eniwetok, had a zero. It looked like that zero was absolutely perfect shape. And not a person lived on the island. It was just somehow, maybe he's off a Japanese carrier or something, you know, and ran out of gas and landed on it.
Maybe it was Amelia Earhart.
Let me tell you about Amelia Earhart now that we're bringing that up. Our office was with the intelligence. I mean, we had an office right there, and I just opened up the file drawers to look and see it. And they had lots of photographs taken by the Navy in 1935 of all those Japanese-held islands. And the Navy said they were going down looking for Amelia Earhart. But what it was, I think some smart guy said, hey, wait a minute, let's see what the Japanese are doing down there. Because they took over all those islands, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there's all kinds of pictures of those islands showing in 1935 what the fortifications they had at that time. But at least it showed, gave them an idea of what that island looked like.
So the search for Amelia Earhart had a dual purpose.
I'm positive of that.
Uh-huh. Well, there's a lot of new theories about Amelia Earhart that are getting a lot of publicity and momentum. And, you know, that certainly adds fuel to the fire. Just to know about that. Some people think that she was performing reconnaissance on that flight. Was it a big deal to you guys? I know your job had to do with the weather, and you weren't firing at anyone yourself. But when you found out that Japan had surrendered and that this thing is all over, was that a significant day for you?
Oh, man, was it. Everybody knew it was just a matter of time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, look at all the men it saved. Then there were two bombs they dropped. Some do-gooders, you know, say that was a terrible thing to do, but you really lost hundreds of thousands of men going into Japan. Look what they did with the kamikaze pilots, what they did to our fleet.
Just the conservative estimates said an invasion would have cost 1 million American lives and way more Japanese lives than that. And you eventually got to come home and see your wife again and see that baby you hadn't met yet.
Right.
What was that homecoming like for you?
Well, I cried. I cried when I left and I cried when I came home.
Mm-hmm. And how old was your daughter?
She was 6 months old.
Can you describe what that's like? You know, because there were days I'm sure you weren't convinced you were ever going to get to meet her. And then you get to hold this little girl.
The only time I worried was when I was in the typhoon. When the war was over, we still had to fly in the typhoons. And then all of a sudden, the points came through, and they were taking people home. And Eniwetok Atoll was a small thing. Well, they had 10,000 Marines there. They were going to be in on the invasion. They were picked up by special ships. But as far as the Navy was concerned, there was just a few of us actually there as officers that could be relieved. So the ships were bypassing Eniwetok. So a Marine plane came through. It was a Navy officer that ran the airport and, of course, a good friend. He told us about this Marine plane there. So I went and talked to the Marine officer that had the C-3 twin engine. Just a small group of Marine officers had a Jeep that they'd swiped in Okinawa, loaded it onto the airplane. And so I asked him if me and my friend couldn't get a ride to Hawaiian Islands because we'd been waiting out there almost a month. And so we got to Hawaii. You have to turn your orders into an office there. And he signed us to a ship. It wouldn't be for 2 weeks. That was on a Friday evening we went in there. On Saturday, we went over to the Marine base where a friend of mine was a weather forecaster. And the Marine base is on the other side of the island through the path from Honolulu. You have to go up through the mountains, through a pass, and drop down on the beach on the other side where they had the Marine Air Base. And we told him our problem. He said, you know, there's a plane that's waiting. I just was going to call him to give him clearance to fly to San Diego. He said, maybe you can get a ride with him. He said, I'll hold off. So we got into a taxi. We raced to the airport and talked to the captain if we could ride with him. And he said, sure, you can ride with me. And so then we went back and got our orders out of the little shack that takes care of that. And then we came back and we called our friend, the weather officer at the Marine Air Station. So when we went to talk to the captain of the PB-4Y2 that's waiting on orders, he said, I'm just waiting any time for them to give me clearance. And so when I called the airport, then he called the captain of the plane and gave him clearance, and we got aboard the airplane. We flew back at I think 11,000 feet. We had our gear, all our gear, coats and everything in a bag, which they threw into the plane. And we froze to death going from Honolulu up at 11,000 feet. It was just freezing.
I bet.
We had little seats against the cabin. It wasn't a chairs like you have on a transport. We had just kind of a little deal to sit on with a belt. It was a terrible trip, but took the train from San Diego to Los Angeles. Then took a Greyhound bus to Bakersfield where they met us.
You were one of four brothers who served, and you all four came home. You did go to pharmacy school. You once played football for UCLA, but you ended up with a USC degree. I mean, did UCLA ever forgive you for that?
No. My football playing at UCLA was short-lived. Our coach here in Shafter High School had been an All-American end for UCLA. I think he was here for 2 years, and I played under him. And they brought him back to UCLA at the same time I was going down to UCLA out of high school. I had an end right away, and playing second string, never played in a football game. But in practice, I got clipped. I was playing the defensive end and came around to make the tackle, and one of them clipped me and knocked my knee out of place.
So that was it.
That was it. That was the end of my football playing.
But after World War II, pharmacy school at USC, followed by a return to his hometown of Shafter.
I had the best job that anybody could have, being a pharmacist of the only drugstore in town, born and raised in the town, graduated from all the schools here in Shafter. Knowing so many people here, I had the best job in the world.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country in such a unique way. Thank you for telling us your story so we understand a little more now. Is there anything else that you want to say about those guys that you served with and how they should be remembered all these years later?
They all should be remembered. And I think that's a problem today. People have forgotten all about. And thanks to you, Paul, you're the one keeping it alive. If it weren't for you, there'd be no knowledge or of anything that went on, and people would forget about it, all this new generation. And thanks to you, and I'm really proud to meet you and talk to you and given a chance to tell my side of the story. And I think that what you're doing is a tremendous thing. It is just absolutely wonderful.
Wow.
People don't know. My own grandkids don't know. I've never sat down and talked with them like I've been talked to you, you know. And I think it's a wonderful thing you're doing. Nobody has the time anymore to talk to someone in the service that was there. So I think what you're doing is a tremendous thing.
It's a privilege to share your story with your grandkids and other people listening. And since we're on that topic, as you look back, everything that you did in the military, in business, seeing your children carrying on those kind of businesses, when you look back over all of it, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I've been proud of all my family. Our whole family are Christians. I think there's lots of things that I could have done better, but it's a unique opportunity to do what I had in. A poor farm boy enters into a going drugstore without putting any money into it except time and effort. I was very fortunate. Extremely fortunate.
Extremely fortunate. That describes the feeling of anybody who ever got to experience the giving heart of Mert Weedman, who passed away this week at the age of 97. I read you just a few of the glowing comments about Mert from the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and there are so many more where those came from if you want to spend a little time online. But I want to read you one more quote from his daughter, Lynn Taylor, who Mert continued to support as a part-time pharmacist in her business until he was 95. He encouraged us to think we could achieve anything, Lynn said of Mert as a father to his four children. And he always said to me in stressful times, don't panic. He said it calmly and meant to try to concentrate on fixing whatever the problem was. Don't panic. I can't help but wonder if that's what he was thinking while flying into typhoons. And perhaps that advice is relevant for your life. There are plenty of figurative typhoons we all encounter, seemingly overwhelming situations that are out of our control. Mert Weedman endured so many of those in his 97 years. Some of you listening had the privilege of knowing him, and I hope I'll get to see you at his memorial service in Shafter, California on October 30th. And for the rest of you, it really doesn't matter where you're listening today. Well, there's only one Mert. I bet you can think of somebody in your hometown who had a similar kind of impact in making it a better place to live. So here's one final idea for you. If that person is still around, why not go thank him or her while you still can? And whether those people are still with us or not, what's stopping us from setting the same kind of example and making the same kind of difference Mert Weedman did for nearly a century? Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.